Do you feel a shiver up your spine from fear? Yes, it's another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind. Amp up your imagination and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted.
The Cave of Echoes, a strange but true story by Helena Blavatsky. In one of the distant governments of the Russian Empire, in a small town on the borders of Siberia, a mysterious tragedy occurred more than 30 years ago. About 6 versts from the little town of P, famous for the wild beauty of its scenery and for the wealth of its inhabitants, generally proprietors of mines and of iron foundries, stood an aristocratic mansion. Its household consisted of the master, a rich old bachelor, and his brother, who was a widower and the father of 2 sons and 3 daughters. It was known that the proprietor, Mr. Ivitskov, had adopted his brother's children, and having formed an especial attachment for his eldest nephew, Nicholas, he had made him the sole heir of his numerous estates. Time rolled on. The uncle was getting old. The nephew was coming of age. Days and years had passed in monotonous serenity, when on the hitherto clear horizon of the quiet family appeared a cloud. On an unlucky day, one of the nieces took it into her head to study the zither. The instrument being of purely Teutonic origin, and no teacher of it residing in the neighborhood, the indulgent uncle sent to St. Petersburg for both. Their diligent search, only one professor could be found, willing to trust himself in such close proximity to Siberia. It was an old German artist, who, sharing his affections equally between his instrument and a pretty blonde daughter, would part with neither. And thus it came to pass that one fine morning the old professor arrived at the mansion with his music box under one arm and his fair mansion leaning on the other. From that day, the little cloud began growing rapidly, for every vibration of the melodious instrument found a responsive echo in the old bachelor's heart. Music awakens love, they say, and the work begun by the zither was completed by Munchen's blue eyes. At the expiration of 6 months, the niece had become an expert zither player, and the uncle was desperately in love. One morning, gathering his adopted family around him, he embraced them all very tenderly, promised to remember them in his will, and wound up by declaring his unalterable resolution to marry the blue-eyed Munchen. After this, he fell upon their necks and wept in silent rapture. The family, understanding that they were cheated out of the inheritance, also wept, but it was for another cause. Having thus wept, they consoled themselves and tried to rejoice, for the old gentleman was sincerely beloved by all. Not all of them rejoiced, though. Nicholas, who had himself been smitten to the heart by the pretty German, and who found himself defrauded at once of his bell and of his uncle's money, neither rejoiced nor consoled himself, but disappeared for a whole day. Meanwhile, Mr. Isakov had given orders to prepare his traveling carriage on the following day, and it was whispered that he was going to the chief town of the district at some distance from his home with the intention of altering his will. Though very wealthy, he had no superintendent on his estate, but kept his books himself. The same evening, after supper, he was heard in his room angrily scolding his servant, who had been in his service for over 30 years. This man, Ivan, was a native of Northern Asia from Kamchatka. He had been brought up by the family in the Christian religion and was thought to be very much attached to his master. A few days later, when the first tragic circumstance I am about to relate had brought all the police force to the spot, it was remembered that on that night Ivan was drunk, that his master, who had a horror of this vice, had paternally thrashed him and turned him out of his room, and that Ivan had been seen reeling out of the door and had been heard to mutter threats. On the vast domain of Mr. Itzhakov, there was a curious cavern, which excited the curiosity of all who visited it. It exists to this day and is well known to every inhabitant of P. A pine forest, commencing a few feet from the garden gate, climbs in steep terraces up a long range of rocky hills, which it covers with a broad belt of impenetrable vegetation. The grotto, leading into the cavern, which is known as the Cave of the Echoes, is situated about half a mile from the site of the mansion, from which it appears as a small excavation in the hillside, almost hidden by luxuriant plants, but not so completely as to prevent any person entering it from being readily seen from the terrace in front of the house. Entering the grotto, the explorer finds at the rear a narrow cleft, having passed through which he emerges into a lofty cavern, feebly lighted through fissures in the vaulted roof, 50 feet from the ground. The cavern itself is immense and would easily hold between 200 and 300 people. A part of it, in the days of Mr. Itzhakov, was paved with flagstones and was often used in the summer as a ballroom by picnic parties. Of an irregular oval, it gradually narrows into a broad corridor, which runs for several miles underground, opening here and there into other chambers, as large and lofty as the ballroom. But unlike this, impassable otherwise than in a boat, as they are always full of water. These natural basins have the reputation of being unfathomable. On the margin of the first of these is a small platform, with several mossy rustic seats arranged on it, and it is from this spot that the phenomenal echoes which give the cavern its name are heard in all their weirdness. A word pronounced in a whisper, or even a sigh, is caught up by endless mocking voices, and instead of diminishing in volume as honest echoes do, the sound grows louder and louder at every successive repetition, until at last it bursts forth like the repercussion of a pistol shot and recedes in a plaintive wail down the corridor. On the day in question, Mr. Itzhakov had mentioned his intention of having a dancing party in this cave on his wedding day, which he had fixed for an early date. On the following morning, while preparing for his drive, he was seen by his family entering the grotto, accompanied only by his Siberian servant. Half an hour later, Ivan returned to the mansion for a snuff box, which his master had forgotten in his room, and went back with it to the cave. An hour later, the whole house was startled by his loud cries. Pale and dripping with water, Ivan rushed in like a madman and declared that Mr. Itzhakov was nowhere to be found in the cave. Thinking he had fallen into the lake, he had dived into the first basin in search of him and was nearly drowned himself. The day passed in vain attempts to find the body. The police filled the house, and louder than the rest in his despair was Nicholas, the nephew, who had returned home only to meet the sad tidings. A dark suspicion fell upon Ivan the Siberian. He had been struck by his master the night before, and had been heard to swear revenge. He had accompanied him alone to the cave, and when his room was searched, a box full of rich family jewelry, known to have been carefully kept in Mr. Itzhakov's apartments, was found under Ivan's bedding. Vainly did the serf call God to witness that the box had been given to him in charge by his master himself, just before they proceeded to the cave, that it was the latter's purpose to have the jewelry reset as he intended it for a wedding present to his bride, and that he, Ivan, would willingly give his own life to recall that of his master if he knew him to be dead. No heed was paid to him, however, and he was arrested and thrown into prison upon a charge of murder. There he was left, for under the Russian law, criminal cannot at any rate, he could not in those days be sentenced for a crime, however conclusive the circumstantial evidence, unless he confessed his guilt. After a week had passed in useless search, the family arrayed themselves in deep mourning, and as the will, as originally drawn, remained without a codicil, the whole of the property passed into the hands of the nephew. The old teacher and his daughter bore his sudden reverse of fortune with true dramatic phlegm, and prepared to depart. Taking again his zither under one arm, the old man was about to lead away his moonshine by the other when the nephew stopped him by offering himself as a fair damsel's husband in the place of his departed uncle. The change was found to be an agreeable one, and without much ado, the young people were married. 10 years rolled away, and we meet the happy family once more at the beginning of 1859. The fair Moonshin has grown fat and vulgar. From the day of the old man's disappearance, Nicholas had become morose and retired in his habits. Many wondered at the change in him, for now he was never seen to smile. It seemed as if his only aim in life were to find out his uncle's murderer, or rather to bring Ivan to confess his guilt. But the man still persisted that he was innocent. An only son had been born to the young couple, and a strange child it was. Small, delicate, and ever ailing, his frail life seemed to hang by a thread. When his features, when repose, his resemblance to his uncle was so striking that the members of the family often shrank from him in terror. It was the pale, shriveled face of a man of 60 upon the shoulders of a child 9 years old. He was never seen either to laugh or to play, but perched in his high chair, would gravely sit there, folding his arms in a way peculiar to the late Mr. Itzikoff, and thus he would remain for hours, drowsy and motionless. His nurse were often seen furtively crossing themselves at night upon approaching him. Not one of them would consent to sleep alone with him in the nursery. His father's behavior towards him was still more strange. He seemed to love him passionately and at the same time to hate him bitterly. He seldom embraced or caressed a child, but with livid cheek and staring eye, he would pass long hours watching him as a child sat quietly in his corner in his goblin-like, old-fashioned way. The child had never left the estate, and few outside the family knew of his existence. About the middle of July, a tall Hungarian traveler, preceded by a great reputation for eccentricity, wealth, and mysterious powers, arrived at the town of P. from the north, where it was said he had resided for many years. He settled in the little town in company with a shaman or South Siberian magician, on whom he was said to make mesmeric experiments. He gave dinners and parties, and invariably exhibited his shaman, of whom he felt very proud, for the amusement of his guests. One day the notables of P. made an unexpected invasion of the domains of Nicholas Ivorkoff, and requested the loan of his cave for an evening entertainment. Nicholas consented with great reluctance, and only after still greater hesitancy was he prevailed upon to join the party. The first cavern and the platform beside the bottomless lake glittered with lights. Hundreds of flickering candles and torches stuck in the clefts of the rocks illuminated the place and drove the shadows from the mossy nooks and corners where they had crouched undisturbed for many years. The stalactites on the walls sparkled brightly, and the sleeping echoes were suddenly awakened by a joyous confusion of laughter and conversation. The shaman, who was never lost sight of by his friend and patron, sat in a corner, entranced as usual. Crouched on a projecting rock, about midway between the entrance and the water, with his lemon-yellow wrinkled face, flat nose, and thin beard, he looked more like an ugly stone idol than a human being. Many of the company pressed around him and received correct answers to the question, the Hungarian cheerfully submitting his mesmerized subject to cross-examination. Suddenly, one of the party later remarked that it was in that very cave that old Mr. Itzikoff had so unaccountably disappeared 10 years before. The foreigner appeared interested and desired to learn more of the circumstances, so Nicholas was sought amid the crowd and led before the eager group. He was the host, and he found it impossible to refuse the demanded narrative. He repeated the sad tale in a trembling voice, with a pallid cheek, and tears were seen glittering in his feverish eyes. The company were greatly affected, and encomiums upon the behavior of the loving nephew in honoring the memory of his uncle and benefactor were freely circulating in whispers, when suddenly the voice of Nicholas became choked. His eyes darted from their sockets, and with a suppressed groan, he staggered back. Every eye in the crowd followed with curiosity his haggard look as it fell and remained riveted upon a weazened little face that peeped from behind the back of the Hungarian. "Where do you come from? Who brought you here, child?" gasped out Nicholas, as pale as death. "I was in bed, Papa. This man came to me and brought me here in his arms," answered the boy simply, pointing to the shaman, beside whom he stood upon the rock, and with his eyes closed kept swaying himself to and fro like a living pendulum. "That is very strange," remarked one of the guests, "for the man has never moved from his place." "Good God, what an extraordinary resemblance," muttered an old resident of the town, a friend of the lost man. "You lie, child," fiercely exclaimed the father. "Go to bed. This is no place for you." "Come, come," interposed the Hungarian, with a strange expression on his face, and encircling with his arm the slender, childish figure. "The little fellow has seen the double of my shaman, which roams sometimes far away from his body, and has mistaken the phantom for the man himself. Let him remain with us for a while." At these strange words, the guests stared at each other in mute surprise, while some piously made the sign of the cross, spitting aside, presumably, at the devil and all his works. "By the by," continued the Hungarian, with a peculiar firmness of accent, and addressing the company rather than anyone in particular, "why should we not try, with the help of my shaman, to unravel the mystery hanging over the tragedy? Is the suspected party still lying in prison? What? He has not confessed up to now? This is surely very strange. But now we will learn the truth in a few minutes. Let us all keep silent." He then approached the shaman and immediately began his performance, without so much as asking the consent of the master of the place. The latter stood rooted to the spot, as if petrified with horror, and unable to articulate a word. The suggestion met with general approbation, save from him and the police inspector, Colonel S., especially approved of the idea. "Ladies and gentlemen," said the mesmerizer in soft tones, "allow me for this once to proceed otherwise than in my general fashion. I will employ the method of native magic. It is more appropriate to this wild place, and far more effective, as you will find, than our European method of mesmerization." Without waiting for an answer, he drew from a bag that never left his person first a small drum, and then two little phials, one full of fluid, the other empty. With the contents of the former he sprinkled the shaman, who fell to trembling and nodding more violently than ever. The air was filled with the perfume of spicy odors, and the atmosphere itself seemed to become clearer. Then, to the horror of those present, he approached the Tibetan, and taking a miniature stiletto from his pocket, he plunged the sharp steel into the man's forearm and drew blood from it, which he caught in the empty phial. When it was half filled, he pressed the orifice of the wound with his thumb and stopped the flow of blood as easily as if he had corked the bottle, after which he sprinkled the blood over the little boy's head. He then suspended the drum from his neck, and with two ivory drumsticks, which were covered with magic signs and letters, he began beating a sort of reveille to drum up the spirits, as he said. The bystanders, half shocked and half terrified by these extraordinary proceedings, eagerly crowded round him, and for a few moments a dead silence reigned throughout the lofty cavern. Nicholas, with his face livid and corpse-like, stood speechless as before. The mesmerizer had placed himself between the shaman and the platform when he began slow drumming. The first notes were muffled and vibrated so softly in the air that they awakened no echo, but the shaman quickened his pendulum-like motion, and the child became restless. The drummer then began a slow chant, low, impressive, and solemn. As the unknown words issued from his lips, the flames of the candles and torches wavered and flickered until they began dancing in rhythm with the chant. A cold wind came wheezing from the dark corridors beyond the water, leaving a plaintive echo on its trail. Then a sort of nebulous vapor, seeming to ooze from the rocky ground and walls, gathered about the shaman and the boy. Around the latter, the aura was silvery and transparent, but the cloud which enveloped the former was red and sinister. Approaching nearer to the platform, the magician beat a louder roll upon the drum, and this time the echo caught it up with a terrible effect. It reverberated near and far in incessant peals. One wail followed another, louder and louder, until the thundering roar seemed the chorus of a thousand demon voices rising from the fathomless depths of the lake. The water itself, whose surface illuminated by many lights had previously been smooth as a sheet of glass, became suddenly agitated as if a powerful gust of wind had swept over its unruffled face. Another chant and a roll of the drum, and the mountain trembled to its foundation with the cannon-like peals which rolled through the dark and distant quarters. The shaman's body rose 2 yards in the air, and nodding and swaying, sat half-suspended like an apparition. But the transformation which now occurred in the boy chilled everyone, as they speechlessly watched the scene. The silvery cloud about the boy now seemed to lift him too into the air, but unlike the shaman, his feet never left the ground. The child began to grow, as though the work of years was miraculously accomplished in a few seconds. He became tall and large, and his senile features grew older with the aging of his body. A few more seconds, and the youthful form had entirely disappeared. It was totally absorbed in another individuality, and to the horror of those present who had been familiar with his appearance, this individuality was that of old Mr. Itzikoff, and on his temple was a large gaping wound from which trickled great drops of blood. This phantom moved towards Nicholas, till it stood directly in front of him, while he, with his hair standing erect, with the look of a madman, gazed at his own son transformed into his uncle. The sepulchral silence was broken by the Hungarian, who, addressing the child phantom, asked him in a solemn voice, "In the name of the great master, of him who has all power, answer the truth, and nothing but the truth. Restless spirit, hast thou been lost by accident or foully murdered?" The specter's lips moved, but it was the echo which answered for them in lugubrious shouts. "Murdered! Murdered! Murdered!" "Where? How? By whom?" asked the conjurer. The apparition pointed a finger at Nicholas, and without removing its gaze or lowering its arm, retreated backward slowly towards the lake. At every step it took, the younger Itzikoff, as if compelled by some irresistible fascination, advanced a step towards it, until the phantom reached the lake, and the next moment was seen gliding on its surface. It was a fearful, ghostly scene. When he had come within 2 steps of the brink of the watery abyss, a violent convulsion ran through the frame of the guilty man. Flinging himself upon his knees, he clung to one of the rustic seats with a desperate clutch, and staring wildly, uttered a long, piercing cry of agony. The phantom now remained motionless on the water, and bending its extended fingers, slowly beckoned him to come. Crouched in abject terror, the wretched man shrieked, until the cavern rang again and again. "I did not. No, I did not murder you." Then came a splash, and out was the boy who was in the dark water, struggling for his life in the middle of the lake with the same motionless, stern apparition brooding over him. "Papa, Papa, save me. I'm drowning," cried a piteous little voice amid the uproar of the mocking echoes. "My boy," shrieked Nicholas in the accents of a maniac, springing to his feet. "My boy, save him, oh, save him. Yes, I confess, I am the murderer. It is I who killed him." Another splash, and the phantom disappeared. With a cry of horror, the company rushed towards the platform, but their feet were suddenly rooted to the ground, as they saw amid the swirling eddies a whitish, shapeless mass, holding the murderer and the boy in tight embrace, and slowly sinking into the bottomless lake. On the morning after these occurrences, when after a sleepless night some of the party visited the residence of the Hungarian gentleman, they found it closed and deserted. He and the shaman had disappeared. Many are among the old inhabitants of P who remember him. The police inspector, Colonel S., dying a few years ago in the full assurance that the noble traveler was the devil. To add to the general consternation, the Itzikoff mansion took fire on that same night and was completely destroyed. The archbishop performed the ceremony of exorcism, but the locality is considered accursed to this day. The government investigated the facts and ordered silence. The Story of Yand Manor House by E. and H. Heron. Looking through the notes of Mr. Flaxman Lowe, one sometimes catches through the steel-blue hardness of facts the pink flush of romance, or more often the black corner of a horrible unnameable. The following story may serve as an instance of the latter. Mr. Lowe not only unraveled the mystery at Yand, but at the same time justified his life work to Monsieur Terry, the well-known French critic and philosopher. At the end of a long conversation Monsieur Thierry, arguing from his own standpoint as a materialist, had said. The factor in the human condition, which you call soul, cannot be placed. I admit that, replied Lo. Yet, when a man dies, is there not one factor unaccounted for in the change that comes upon him? Yes. For though his body still exists, it rapidly falls to pieces, which proves that that has gone which held it together. The Frenchman laughed and shifted his ground. Well, for my part, I don't believe in ghosts. Spirit manifestations, occult phenomena. Is not this the ashbin into which a certain clique shoot everything they cannot understand, or for which they fail to account? Then what would you say to me, Monsieur, if I told you that I have passed a good portion of my life in investigating this particular ashbin, and have been lucky enough to sort a small part of its contents with tolerable success, replied Flaxman Low. The subject is doubtless interesting, but I should like to have some personal experience in the matter, said Terry dubiously. I am at present investigating a most singular case, said Low. Have you a day or two to spare? Terry thought, for a minute or more. I am grateful, he replied, but forgive me. Is it a convincing ghost? Come with me to Yand and see. I have been there once already, and came away for the purpose of procuring information from someone to which I have the privilege of access, for I confess that the phenomena at Yand lie altogether outside any former experience of mine. Lo sank back into his chair, with his hands clasped behind his head, a favorite position of his, and the smoke of his long pipe curled up lazily into the golden face of an Isis, which stood behind him on a bracket. Terry, glancing across, was struck by the strange likeness between the faces of the Egyptian goddess and the scientist of the 19th century. On both rested the calm, mysterious abstraction of some unfathomable thought. As he looked, he decided, I have 3 days to place at your disposal. I thank you heartily, replied Lo. To be associated with so brilliant a logician as yourself in an inquiry of this nature is more than I could have hoped for. The material with which I have to deal is so elusive, the whole subject is wrapped in such obscurity and hampered by so much prejudice, that I can find few really qualified persons who care to approach these investigations seriously. I go down to Yang this evening and hope not to leave without clearing up the mystery. You will accompany me? Most certainly. Meanwhile, pray tell me something of the affair. Briefly, the story is as follows. Some weeks ago, I went to Yand Manor House at the request of the owner, Sir George Blackburton, to see what I could make of the events which took place there. All they complain of is the impossibility of remaining in one room, the dining room. What then is he like, this Monsieur Le Spook? Asked the Frenchman, laughing. No one has ever seen him, or for that matter, heard him. Then how? You can't see him, nor hear him, nor smell him, went on Lo. But you can feel him and taste him. Mon Dieu, but this is singular. Is he then of so bad a flavor? You shall taste for yourself, answered Flaxman Lo, smiling. After a certain hour, no one can remain in the room. They are simply crowded out. But who crowds them out? Asked Harry. That is just what I hope we may discover tonight or tomorrow. The last train that night dropped Mr. Flaxman Lo and his companion at a little station near Yand. It was late, but a trap in waiting soon carried them to the manor house. The big bulk of the building stood up in absolute blackness before them. Blackburton was to have met us, but I suppose he has not yet arrived, said Low. Hello, the door is open, he added as he stepped into the hall. Beyond a dividing curtain, they now perceived a light. Passing behind the curtain, they found themselves at the end of the long hall, the wide staircase opening up in front of them. But who is this? Exclaimed Terry. Swaying and stumbling at every step, there tottered slowly down the stairs the figure of a man. He looked as if he had been drinking. His face was livid, and his eyes sunk into his head. Thank heaven you've come. I heard you outside, he said in a weak voice. It's Sir George Blackburton, said Lo, as the man lurched forward and pitched into his arms. They laid him down on the rugs and tried to restore consciousness. He has the air of being drunk, but it is not so, remarked Terry. Monsieur has had a bad shock of the nerves. See the pulses drumming in his throat? In a few minutes, Blackburton opened his eyes and staggered to his feet. Come. I could not remain there alone. Come quickly. They went rapidly across the hall, Black Burton leading the way down a wide passage to a double-leaved door, which after a perceptible pause he threw open, and they all entered together. On the great table in the center stood an extinguished lamp, some scattered food and a big lighted candle. But the eyes of all three men passed at once to a dark recess beside the heavy carved chimney piece, where a rigid shape sat perched on the back of a huge oak chair. Flaxman Lowe snatched up the candle and crossed the room towards it. On the top of this chair, with his feet upon the arm, sat a powerfully built young man huddled up. His mouth was open and his eyes twisted upwards. Nothing further could be seen from below but the ghastly pallor of cheek and throat. "Who is this?" cried Lowe. Then he laid his hand gently on the man's knee. At the touch, the figure collapsed in a heap upon the floor, the gaping, set, terrified face turned up to theirs. "He's dead," said Lowe after a hasty exclamation. "I should say he's been dead some hours." "Oh, Lord, poor Batty," groaned Sir George, who was entirely unnerved. "I'm glad you've come, Lowe." "Who is he?" said Terry. "And what was he doing here?" "He's a gamekeeper of mine. He was always anxious to try conclusions with a ghost, and last night he begged me to lock him in here with food for 24 hours. I was opposed to it, but then I thought if anything happened while he was in here alone, it would interest you. Who could imagine it would end like this?" "When did you find him?" asked Lowe. "I only got here from my mother's half an hour ago. I turned on the light in the hall and came in here with a candle. As I entered the room, the candle went out and... I think I must be going mad." "Tell us everything you saw," urged Lowe. "You will think I'm beside myself. But as the light went out and I sank almost paralyzed into an armchair, I saw two barred eyes looking at me." "Barred eyes? What do you mean?" "Eyes that looked at me through thin vertical bars, like the bars of a cage." "What's that?" With a smothered yell, Sir George sprang back. He had approached the dead man and declared something had brushed his face. "You were standing on this spot, under the overmantel. I will remain here. Meantime, my dear Terry, I feel sure you will help Sir George to carry this poor fellow to some more suitable place," said Flaxman Lowe. When the dead body of the young gamekeeper had been carried out, Lowe passed slowly around and about the room. At length, he stood under the old carved overmantel, which reached to the ceiling and projected boldly forward in quaint heads of satyrs and animals. One of these, on the side nearest the recess, presented a griffin with a fanged mouth. Sir George had been standing directly below this at the moment when he felt the touch on his face. Now alone in the dim, wide room, Flaxman Lowe stood on the same spot and waited. The candle threw its dull yellow rays on the shadows, which seemed to gather closer and wait also. Presently, a distant door banged, and Lowe, leaning forward to listen distinctly, felt something on the back of his neck. He swung around. There was nothing. He searched carefully on all sides, then put his hand up to the griffin's head. Again came the same soft touch, this time upon his hand, as if something had floated past on the air. This was definite. The griffin's head located it. Taking the candle to examine more closely, Lowe found four long black hairs depending from the jagged fangs. He was detaching them when Terry reappeared. "We must get Sir George away as soon as possible," he said. "Yes, we must take him away, I fear," agreed Lowe. "Our investigation must be put off till tomorrow." On the following day, they returned to Yand. It was a large country house, pretty and old-fashioned, with latticed windows and deep gables that looked out between tall shrubs and across lawns set with bow pots, where peacocks sunned themselves on the velvet turf. The church spire peered over the trees on one side, and an old wall covered with ivy and creeping plants and pierced at intervals with arches alone separated the gardens from the churchyard. The haunted room lay at the back of the house. It was square and handsome and furnished in the style of the last century. The oak overmantel reached to the ceiling, and a wide window, which almost filled one side of the room, gave a view of the west door of the church. Lowe stood for a moment at the open window, looking out at the level sunlight, which flooded the lawn and parterres. "See that door sunk in the church wall to the left?" said Sir George's voice at his elbow. "That is the door of the family vault. Cheerful outlook, isn't it?" "I should like to walk across the presently," remarked Low. "What? Into the vault?" asked Sir George with a harsh laugh. "I'll take you if you like. Anything else I can show you or tell you?" "Yes. Last night, I found this hanging from the griffin's head," said Low, producing the thin wisp of black hair. "It must have touched your cheek as you stood below. Do you know to whom it can belong?" "It's a woman's hair." "No. The only woman who has been in this room, to my knowledge, for months is an old servant with gray hair who cleans it," returned Black Burton. "I'm sure it was not here when I locked Batty in." "It is human hair, exceedingly coarse and long uncut," said Low. "But it is not necessarily a woman's." "It is not mine, at any rate, for I'm sandy and poor Batty was fair. Good night. I'll come around for you in the morning." Presently, when the night closed in, Terry and Low settled down in the haunted room to await developments. They smoked and talked deep into the night. A big lamp burned brightly on the table, and the surroundings looked homely and desirable. Terry made a remark to that effect, adding that perhaps the ghost might see fit to omit his usual visit. Experience goes to prove that ghosts have a cunning habit of choosing persons either credulous or excitable to experiment upon, he added. To Monsieur Terry's surprise, Flaxman Low agreed with him. "They certainly choose suitable persons," he said. "That is, not credulous persons, but those whose senses are sufficiently keen to detect the presence of a spirit. My own investigations, I tried to eliminate what you would call the supernatural element. I deal with these mysterious affairs as far as possible on material lines." "Then what do you say of Batty's death?" "He died of fright, simply." "I hardly think so. The manner of his death agrees in a peculiar manner with what we know of the terrible history of this room. He died of fright and pressure combined. Did you hear the doctor's remark? It was significant," he said. "The indications are precisely those I've observed in persons who have been crushed and killed in a crowd." "That is sufficiently curious, I allow. I see that it is already past 2 o'clock. I am thirsty. I will have a little seltzer." Terry rose from his chair and, going to the sideboard, drew a thimbleful from the siphon. "What an abominable taste." "What, the seltzer?" "Not at all," returned the Frenchman irritably. "I have not touched it yet. Some horrible fly has flown into my mouth, I suppose. It's disgusting." "What is it like?" asked Flaxman Low, who was at the moment wiping his own mouth with his handkerchief. "Like? As if some repulsive fungus had burst in the mouth." "Exactly. I perceive it also. I hope you are about to be convinced." "What?" exclaimed Terry, turning his big figure around and staring at Low. "You don't mean—" As he spoke, the lamp suddenly went out. "Why, then have you put the lamp out at such a moment?" cried Terry. "I have not put it out. Light the candle beside you on the table." Low heard the Frenchman's grunt of satisfaction as he found the candle, then the scratch of a match. It spluttered and went out. Another match, and another behaved in the same manner, while Terry swore freely under his breath. "Let me have your matches, Monsieur Flaxman. Mine are no doubt damp," he said at last. Low rose to feel his way across the room. The darkness was dense. "It is the darkness of Egypt. It may be felt." "Where then are you, my dear friend?" he heard Terry saying, but the voice seemed a long way off. "I'm coming," he answered, "but it's so hard to get along." After Low had spoken the words, their meaning struck him. He paused and tried to realize on what part of the room he was. The silence was profound, and the growing sense of oppression seemed like a nightmare. Terry's voice sounded again, faint and receding. "I'm suffocating, Monsieur Flaxman. Where are you?" "I'm near the door." A strangling bellow of pain and fear followed that scarcely reached Low through the thickening atmosphere. "Terry, what is the matter with you?" he shouted. "Open the door." But there was no answer. What had become of Terry in that hideous, clogging gloom? Was he also dead, crushed in some ghastly fashion against the wall? What was this? The air had become palpable to the touch, heavy, repulsive, with a sensation of cold, humid flesh. Low pushed out his hands with a mad longing to touch a table, a chair, anything but this clammy, swelling softness that thrust itself upon him from every side, baffling him. and filling his grasp. He knew now that he was absolutely alone, struggling against what? His feet were slipping in his wild efforts to feel the floor. The dank flush was creeping upon his neck, his cheek. His breath came short and laboring as the pressure swung him gently to and fro, helpless, nauseated. The clammy flesh crowded upon him like the bulk of some fat, horrible creature. Then came a stinging pain on the cheek. Lo clutched at something. There was a crash and a rush of air. The next sensation of which Mr. Flaxman Lo was conscious was one of deathly sickness. He was lying on wet grass, the wind blowing over him, and all the clean, wholesome smells of the open air in his nostrils. He sat up and looked about him. Dawn was breaking windily in the east. By its light, he saw that he was on the lawn of Yand Manor House. The lattice window of the haunted room above him was open. He tried to remember what had happened. He took stock of himself, in fact, and slowly felt they still held something clutched in his right hand. Something dark-colored, slender, and twisted. It might have been a long shred of bark on the cast skin of an adder. It was impossible to see in the dim light. After an interval, the recollection of Terry reoccurred to him. Scrambling to his feet, he raised himself to the window still and looked in. Contrary to his expectation, there was no upsetting of furniture. Everything remained positioned as when the lamp went out. His own chair and the one Terry had occupied were just as when they had risen from them, but there was no sign of Terry. Lo jumped in by the window. There was the tumbler full of seltzer and the litter of matches about it. He took up Terry's box of matches and struck a light. It flared, and he lit the candle with ease. In fact, everything about the room was perfectly normal. All the horrible conditions prevailing but a couple of hours ago had disappeared. But where was Terry? Carrying the lighted candle, he passed out the door and searched in the adjoining rooms. In one of them, to his relief, he found the Frenchman sleeping profoundly in an armchair. Lo touched his arm. Terry leapt to his feet, fending off an imaginary blow with his arm. Then he turned his scared face on Lo. "What? You, Monsieur Flaxman? How have you escaped?" "I should rather ask you how you escaped," said Lo, smiling at the havoc the night's experience had worked in his friend's looks and spirit. "I was crowded out of the room against the door. That infernal thing, what was it, with its damp swelling flesh, enclosed me." A shudder of disgust stopped him. "I was a fly in an aspic. I could not move. I sank into the stifling pulp. The air grew thick. I called to you, but your answers became inaudible. Then I was suddenly thrust against the door by a huge hand. It felt like one, at least. I had a struggle for my life. I was all but crushed, and then I do not know how I found myself outside the door. I shouted to you in vain. Therefore, as I could not help you, I came here, and I will confess it, my dear friend. I locked and bolted the door. After some time, I went again into the hall and listened. But as I heard nothing, I resolved to wait until daylight and the return of Sir George." "That's all right," said Lo. "It was an experience worth having. But no, not for me. I do not envy you your researches into mysteries of this abominable description. I now comprehend perfectly that Sir George has lost his nerve if he has had to do with this horror. Besides, it is entirely impossible to explain these things." At this moment, they heard Sir George's arrival and went out to meet him. "I could not sleep all night for thinking of you," exclaimed Black Burton on seeing them, "and I came along as soon as it was light. Something has happened." "But certainly something has happened," cried Monsieur Terry, shaking his head solemnly. "Something of the most bizarre, of the most horrible. Monsieur Flaxman shall tell you, Sir George, this story. You have been in that accursed room all the night and remained alive to tell the tale." As Lo came to the conclusion of the story, Sir George suddenly exclaimed, "You have met with some injury to your face, Mr. Lo?" Lo turned to the mirror. In the now strong light, three parallel wheels from eye to mouth could be seen. "I remember a stinging pain, like a lash on my cheek." "What would you say these marks were caused by, Terry?" asked Lo. Terry looked at them and shook his head. "No one in their senses would venture to offer any explanation of the occurrences of last night," he replied. "Something of this sort, do you think?" asked Lo again, putting down the object he held in his hand on the table. Terry took it up and described it aloud. "A long and thin object of a brown and yellow color and twisted like a saber-bladed corkscrew." Then he started slightly and glanced up at Lo. "It's a human nail, I imagine," suggested Lo. "But no human being has talons of this kind, except perhaps a Chinaman of high rank. There are no Chinamen about here, nor ever have been to my knowledge," said Blackburton shortly. "I'm very much afraid that in spite of all you have so bravely faced, we are no nearer to any rational explanation. On the contrary, I fancy I begin to see my way. I believe, after all, that I may be able to convert you, Terry," said Flaxman Low. "Convert me? To a belief in the definite aim of my work. But you shall judge for yourself. What do you make of it so far? I claim that you know as much of the matter as I do." "My dear good friend, I make nothing of it," returned Terry, shrugging his shoulders and spreading out his hands. "Here we have a tissue of unprecedented incidents that can be explained on no theory whatever." "But this is definite," said Flaxman Low, as he held up the blackened nail. "And how do you propose to connect that nail with the black hairs, with the eyes that look through the bars of a cage, the fate of Batty with its symptoms of death by pressure and suffocation, our experience of swelling flesh, that something which filled and filled the room to the exclusion of all else? How are you going to account for these things by any kind of connected hypothesis?" asked Terry, with a shade of irony. "I mean to try," replied Low. At lunchtime, Terry inquired how the theory was getting on. "It progresses," answered Low. "By the way, Sir George, who lived in this house for some time prior to, say, 1840? "He was a man. It may have been a woman, but from the nature of his studies, I am inclined to think it was a man who was deeply read in ancient necromancy, Eastern magic, mesmerism, and subjects of a kindred nature. And was he not buried in the vault you pointed out?" "Do you know anything more about him?" asked Sir George in surprise. "He was, I imagine," went on Flaxman Low reflectively, "hirsute and swarthy, probably a recluse, and suffered from a morbid and extravagant fear of death." "How do you know all this?" "I only asked about it. Am I right?" "You have described my cousin, Sir Gilbert Blackburton, in every particular. I can show you his portrait in another room." As they stood looking at the painting of Sir Gilbert Blackburton, with his long, melancholy olive face and thick black beard, Sir George went on, "My grandfather succeeded him at Yand. I have often heard my father speak of Sir Gilbert and his strange studies and extraordinary fear of death. Oddly enough, in the end he died rather suddenly, while he was still hale and strong. He predicted his own approaching death and had a doctor in attendance for a week or two before he died. He was placed in a coffin he had made in some plan of his own and buried in the vault. His death occurred in 1843 or 1842. If you care to see them, I can show you some of his papers, which may interest you." Mr. Flaxman Low spent the afternoon over the papers. When evening came, he rose from his work with a sigh of content, stretched himself, and joined Terry and Sir George in the garden. They dined at Lady Blackburton's, and it was late before Sir George found himself alone with Mr. Flaxman Low and his friend. "Have you formed any opinion about the thing which haunts the manor house?" "Yes," anxiously. Terry elaborated a cigarette, crossed his legs, and added, "If you have in truth come to any definite conclusion, pray let us hear it, my dear Monsieur Flaxman." "I've reached a very definite and satisfactory conclusion," replied Low. "The manor house is haunted by Sir Gilbert Blackburton, who died, or rather, who seemed to die, on the 15th of August, 1842. "Nonsense. The nail 15 inches long, at least. How do you connect it with Sir Gilbert?" asked Blackburton testily. "I am convinced that it belonged to Sir Gilbert," Low answered. "But the long black hair, like a woman's." "Dissolution in the case of Sir Gilbert was not complete, not consummated, so to speak, as I hope to show you later. Even in the case of dead persons, the hair nails have been known to grow. By a rough calculation as to the growth of nails in such cases, I was unable to indicate approximately the date of Sir Gilbert's death. The hair, too, grew on his head." "But the barred eyes?" "I saw them myself," exclaimed the young man. "The eyelashes grow also. You follow me?" "You have, I presume, some theory in connection with this?" observed Terry. "It must be a very curious one. So Gilbert, in his fear of death, appears to have mastered and elaborated a strange and ancient formula by which the grosser factors of the body being eliminated, the more ethereal portions continue to retain the spirit and the bodies thus preserved from absolute disintegration. In this manner, true death may be indefinitely deferred. Secure from the ordinary chances and changes of existence, the spiritualized body could retain a modified life practically forever. This is a most extraordinary idea, my dear fellow, remarked Terry. But why should Sir Gilbert haunt the manor house and one special room? The tendency of spirits to return to the old haunts of bodily life is almost universal. We cannot yet explain the reason of this attraction of environment. But the expansion, the crowding substance which we ourselves felt. You cannot meet that difficulty, said Terry persistently. Not as fully as I could wish, perhaps, but the power of expanding and contracting to a degree far beyond our comprehension is a well-known attribute of spiritualized matter. Wait one little moment, my dear Monsieur Flaxman, broke in Terry's voice after an interval. This is very clever and ingenious indeed. As a theory, I give it my sincere admiration. But proof is what we now demand. Flaxman Low looked at the two steadily incredulous faces. This, he said slowly, is the hair of Sir Gilbert Blackburton, and this nail is from the little finger of his left hand. You can prove my assertion by opening the coffin. Sir George, who was pacing up and down the room, impatiently drew up. I don't like it at all, Mr. Low, I tell you frankly. I don't like it at all. I see no object in violating the coffin. I'm not concerned to verify this unpleasant theory of yours. I've only one desire. I want to get rid of this haunting presence, whatever it is. If I am right, replied Low, the opening of the coffin and the exposure of the remains to strong sunshine for a short time will free you forever from this presence. In the early morning, when the summer sun struck warmly on the lawns of Yand, the three men carried the coffin from the vault to a quiet spot among the shrubs, where, secure from observation, they raised the lid. Within the coffin lay the semblance of Gilbert Blackburton, maned to the ears with long and coarse black hair. Matted eyelashes swept the fallen cheeks, and beside the body stretched the bony hands, each with its independent sheaf of switch-like nails. Low bent over and raised the left hand gingerly. The little finger was without a nail. 2 hours later, they came back and looked again. The sun had in the meantime done its work. Nothing remained but a fleshless skeleton and a few half-rotten shreds of clothing. The ghost of Yan Manor House has never since been heard of. When Terry bade Flaxman Low goodbye, he said, In time, my dear Monsieur Flaxman, you will add another to your sciences. You establish your facts too well for my peace of mind.